Welcome, everybody, to our program today. I'm Greg Grisham, president of the Memphis Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. And today we have a wonderful speaker, Professor Jonathan Adler, who I'll introduce in just a moment. But this may or may not be the last program we have in 2021. We may have another. This is our sixth program this year. So, we're excited in the midst of COVID-19 that we can have excellent programming. We hope to get back to live programming in the spring and have a mix of Zoom and live programs. So anyway, thanks again for coming today. What I'd like you to do is, if you have questions, there's a chat box. Please submit your questions there. A Q&A. We'll have Q&A with Professor Adler stop speaking the latter part of the program. And also, if you want CLE credit, please provide me with your BPR number. It makes it easier for me to submit it. So please do that for me. So let me go ahead and give a quick introduction of Professor Adler. His bio, link to his bio will be shared with the other links we're sharing today of articles he's written that are relevant to our topic today. Professor Adler is a Johann Verhey Memorial Professor of Law at Case Western Reserve University. He's also the director of the Coleman Burke Center for Environmental Law. He teaches courses in environmental, administrative, and constitutional law. And he's also been the author and editor of 7 books, including Business in the Roberts Court, Oxford University Press 2016. He's been published all over in the Harvard Environmental Law Review, USA Today, Wall Street Journal. He's testified before Congress about a dozen times and has also been cited by the US Supreme Court in many cases. He's also was a judicial law clerk for Judge David Sintel on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. He also is a graduate of Yale University, received his BA magna cum laude there, and a JD summa cum laude from the George Mason University School of Law. So anyway, Professor Adler, thanks again for being with us today, and we'll turn the program over to you.
Well, great. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for making the time. It's certainly nice to be able to speak with you today. I'm sorry we're not in person, but certainly next time I would be happy to come down to Memphis and have some barbecue and talk about legal questions. And in a twist of fate, we actually have current stuff to talk about. As I am sure many of you have seen, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration this morning released its emergency temporary standard for COVID in the workplace, which I'll talk about in a minute. What I want to do today in my remarks is I want to say a little bit to set the stage about how we should think about federalism in the context of pandemic measures, how we should think about what the federal government legitimately should and should not be doing, both from the standpoint of how to think about federal systems generally, but also given our particular constitution and the roles it assigns to the federal government as opposed to state and local governments. I'm then going to talk a little bit about some of the benefits of having federalism in this sort of context, and then say a little bit about some of the specific measures that the federal government has pursued or is pursuing and how we might think about them in the context of federalism. And then we'll be happy to take questions that you may have about subjects that I've talked about. I think it's valuable to talk about federalism in the context of pandemic measures because there's a lot of commentary out there that suggests that federalism might be good for some things, but when there's an emergency, when something really terrible is happening, well, then maybe not. That federalism results in different jurisdictions doing different things. It's been claimed that federalism results in a disjointed or chaotic response to a pandemic, that it costs lives as a consequence. I'm skeptical of that view, and I'll explain why. But at the same time, of course, there are those, and I'm sure some of the folks here today, when they think about the pandemic, they think about all sorts of other emergencies that the federal government at times points to as an excuse or reason to expand its power and to engage in overreach. That if we think the federal government generally or has a tendency to grow or to expand its authority, we might be particularly concerned about emergencies being used as pretexts. And my own view is, as I'll unpack, I think there are important legitimate things the federal government can and should do in the context of a pandemic, but we should understand those within the constraints created by our federal system, and also with a recognition for the value of decentralization when dealing with this sort of problem, and in particular, the sort of problem that arises with a pandemic like COVID-19. So let me start with some background principles. This some things that I doubt are new to anyone that's here today. We all know that our federal constitution, I have my Cato constitution right here, right? We know that this creates a government, federal government of limited and enumerated powers. It does not create the state governments. They pre-existed the adoption of the federal constitution. They did not derive their authority or power from this document. Rather, they derive their power and authority from the people of each of the states. They have a residual police power. That police power has always been understood to encompass the broad mass of measures that protect health, safety, and morals. In Gibbons versus Ogden, that famous Commerce Clause case where Chief Justice John Marshall was resolving a dispute between two steamboat operators, he referred to the powers of the states as including that immense mass of legislation which embraces everything within the territory of a state not surrendered to the general government, all which can be most advantageously exercised by the states themselves. Inspection laws, quarantine laws, health laws of every description. And so from our founding, we've understood that whether something should be a state or federal issue is not about the importance of the issue, not about whether life and death is involved, not about whether or not it's something we really care about, but really about what powers have been given to the federal government. And as a general matter, the powers that were given to the federal government were those powers that the founders believed were best exercised by a centralized government, that those powers for which there is a comparative advantage to having them exercised centrally for the nation as a whole, again, not a question of, is this an important issue or not? And then of course, historically, most of the big cases concerning what the scope of what government generally may do in the context of controlling the pandemic have been under state or local law, right? So Jacobson versus Massachusetts, case that has gotten a lot of discussion of late, involved a state mandate, not a federal mandate. Historically, we've recognized that the federal government's power involves things that relate to interstate transmission of disease, interstate problems, the fact that a disease in one state could spread to another, certainly then extends to things like ways of interstate commerce, the rail lines, air travel, things of that nature, but not to the things that are wholly internal. Historically, that sort of measure was left to state and local governments. The other background principles is, I think it's just worth keeping in mind, and especially as we start thinking about things that the federal government is doing or trying to do now, is what the role of federal agencies is when we talk about federalism. Right? If I go back to my constitution, we see Article 1 creates a Congress, Article 2 creates an executive, Article 3 creates a judiciary. Article 4 is not agencies, right? Agencies are rather things that have been created by Congress using its Article 1 powers, delegating power to Article 2. And the important point here for us to remember is that agencies have no inherent powers, certainly not domestically. There's an interesting debate about whether that principle applies in the foreign affairs context. That's not relevant for us today. Agencies themselves have no inherent powers. They only have that power that Congress has delegated, that Congress in statute has given to those agencies. And obviously that statute has to pass through bicameralism and presentment. And on top of that, courts generally have been very wary of assuming that Congress has delegated power to an agency to disrupt the traditional bounds of between federal and state power, unless Congress was explicit about it. That if Congress wants to use federal power to dislodge state governments from an area that they have traditionally regulated, we assume, courts have assumed for a long time, and the current court clearly believes this as well, we expect Congress to have been very clear and explicit about that. And that matters in the context of pandemic response, because most of the sorts of health measures, certainly the ones that provoke the most public debate and concern, are the sorts of measures that historically have been adopted by state governments and have not been done by the federal government or controlled or dictated by the federal government. And unless and until Congress suggests that that is changing, we assume that that balance remains in place. Another reason why courts like that principle is because that then helps courts stay out of the more difficult question about whether some assertions of federal power might be unconstitutional. And so we might believe that a state vaccine mandate would be constitutional under Jacobson. If we assume that Jacobson still applies the same way today, but not believe that a federal vaccine mandate would be constitutional, because a federal vaccine mandate would not be necessary and proper to carry into execution one of the federal government's limited or enumerated powers. So I wanted to just remind us of those principles because I think they're important to keep in mind. I think a lot of times in the public discussions of COVID policy, of pandemic response, we forget these background principles about what the federal government is supposed to be doing versus the state governments, as well as where agencies get their power and what agencies can do. Now, a question that has been posed a fair amount is whether this sort of vision makes sense, whether it is something that is still relevant in modern society, or is it just this quaint 18th century notion about how government should be divided and limited? And I think in the public health literature in particular, there's been a lot of criticism of the fact that different states can do different things. That my governor, Mike DeWine, might do something different than New York's former governor, Andrew Cuomo, who might do something different than Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, who might do something different than California governor, Gavin Newsom. And I want to suggest that there are quite a few reasons why constraining the federal government to those areas where the federal government has a distinct comparative advantage, which tend to be those areas where the federal government has delegated authority under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, actually results in better pandemic response. And we should be thankful for our federalist system. And let me explain some of the reasons why I feel that way. First, states are different. I just mentioned New York, California, Florida, Ohio. We could throw Tennessee in, we could throw Montana in. These are very different places and different in ways that are relevant to thinking about what our policies should be with regard to a pandemic. You not only have different populations, you have different population densities, different household sizes, different modes of transit, different climates. This is all relevant, right? We all know that COVID spreads more easily indoors than outdoors. So the surrounding climate matters. Whether you have a mass transit system that large percentages of the population use to get to and from work matters. Whether you have dense urban centers in your state matters. Whether or not people's living arrangements are such that you have to worry about at-home spread, a significant at-home spread matters as well. And it's hard for a national policy to appropriately account for all those differences. In parts of the country that are really hot, we might actually expect COVID spread to be higher in the summer when people are inside to avoid the heat in places that are air conditioned. But in colder places, we might expect the opposite. We might, because folks are going to be outdoors more in the summer, more indoors in the winter because of the cold. We need to recognize these sorts of differences. Another point that related to that is, as Alexis de Tocqueville noted, that in large centralized nations like ours, the lawgiver is bound to give the laws a uniform character which does not fit the diversity of places and mores. right? That in a country as broad and diverse and varied as the United States, it's hard to adopt a single policy that makes sense everywhere. In terms of dealing with the difference of places, I've already mentioned temperature and climate, but that affects really basic things. Like, we know ventilation in schools is arguably the most effective thing you can do to reduce the spread of COVID in schools, more significant than masking kids or anything like that. In some parts of the country, leaving windows open in classrooms is something viable. In other parts of the country, it's not. A single national rule about whether schools should or should not leave windows open to improve ventilation would not make sense. But as de Tocqueville's quote also notes, it's not just about differences in places. It's also about differences in mores. Right? COVID does not present a black or white question. You either are stopping it or not stopping it. It's a question of what measures do people want on the margin that will reduce risks on the margin, that a lot of health COVID policy, like environmental policy, where I do a lot of work, like health policy generally, like other types of risk and safety policy, involve questions of risk preferences and improvements on the margin. And the reality is that different people have different preferences. Some people look at the data and look at the research and say, you know, less than 1/1000th of the deaths from COVID to date have been people under 18. So I'm not really worried about masking kids in schools because they're not going to get it. And they're not gonna suffer. Other people say, well, but wait, it's our kids. We should be extra careful. We should adopt a precautionary approach. Right? That's a values debate. That's a normative debate about what costs or measures or burdens are we willing to adopt to reduce a risk on the margin. And there is no uniformity on those sorts of questions in our country. And centralizing those decisions means we are less likely to allow people to live in jurisdictions where the laws and rules match their preferences. Decentralizing those decisions makes it more likely that people are living under rules that are consistent with their value preferences. Another reason why we should like decentralization is that states and state governments are better positioned to access local knowledge. I've talked about all these differences, but knowledge and understanding about what those differences mean in practice is more readily known and understood at the local level, and certainly better at the state level than at the federal level. This is essentially Nobel laureate economist F.A. Hayek's central insight about the use of knowledge and why central planning fails, that a lot of the relevant information for policymaking occurs at the local level, what's actually occurring in particular school districts, in particular businesses, in particular communities. Relatedly, decentralization encourages discovery. If you followed the science on COVID-19 from the very beginning, you realize that there are a lot of things we thought at the beginning that we know now aren't true. People made a lot of mistakes. We made assumptions about it being like other diseases or not. And the reality is, when it comes to control measures, allowing different jurisdictions to do different things actually helps us learn what sorts of policies are most effective. Having New York adopt one policy with regard to nursing homes and Ohio adopt a different policy for nursing homes allowed us to learn that what Governor Cuomo did was disastrous. Now, one might argue, well, maybe the federal government would have just done what Ohio did. Maybe the federal government also might have done what New York did, and that would have been disastrous for residents of nursing homes nationwide. So decentralizing both helps us discover and learn what sorts of mix of policies do better. It also reduces the downside risk of adopting the wrong policy. And if you look at the relevant literature on prior pandemics, for example, the 1918 Spanish flu, so much of what we know about what did not work in 1918 is based on the fact that not every jurisdiction did the same thing. And so we can look at the data, we can look at what different jurisdictions did, and we can learn from that. And there's already been a lot of research to date, research that policymakers don't always pay attention to, but there certainly has been a lot of research to date on COVID showing that different jurisdictions have done different things. And so we've learned a lot about what to do with regard to, say, nursing homes, what the consequences are of various shutdown orders, allowing reopening or not, what the results are from different school-related measures or not. And this is important because a lot of times it's not simply an on-off switch. Policy is often not an on-off switch. Rather, it's a very textured, nuanced set of decisions on multiple margins. And each of those margins may matter. And allowing different jurisdictions to do different things really rapidly accelerates our ability to identify better policies and avoid bad policies. And on that last point about bad policies, remember, when a bad policy is adopted at the federal level, that's a mistake that applies everywhere. And my own view is that we should be more concerned about nationalizing the mistake than we are about losing the opportunity to nationalize success, where policies are clearly beneficial and are the sort of things that the vast majority of people would support. We tend to see state governments and local governments replicating the successful measures of their neighbors. And where they don't, it's often because they have different values, different risk preferences, a different view about the relevant trade-offs. And we should be okay with that, just as we have different policies about marijuana or different policies about a wide range of federal policy, or sorry, a wide range of public policies. We should be okay with that when it comes to health as well. One last point, just in terms of thinking about, or two last points about just thinking about federalism in the abstract. Something else that I think that a lot of policymakers underestimate, a lot of public health folks underestimate, is that another benefit of our federal system is that decentralization of power creates alternative centers of power that can push back against misguided federal policy. We think about that a lot in terms of state attorneys general suing the federal government, but I think it also occurs, and perhaps it occurs more importantly, in a softer way. And one example of that I think is useful, and that was salient to us here in Ohio, is early on in the pandemic, as you may all remember, there was concern about shortages of personal protective equipment, especially for frontline workers. And this is an issue that mattered to me because my daughter, among other things, works in an emergency room here in Cleveland. And a lot of folks coming into the emergency room early in COVID were COVID positive, and there not being PPE for people like my daughter mattered. That certainly mattered to me, and I think it mattered to a lot of us. We wanted those folks who were on the front lines to be able to protect themselves. And a company in Columbus came up with a way of cleaning masks, N95 masks in a way that doesn't cause the masks to lose their effectiveness, but would allow them to be reused and thereby deal with the PPE shortage that we were dealing with. And the FDA resisted approving this cleaning technology. And when it eventually approved it, initially approved it with so many limitations that it might as well have said that it was prohibited. But because this was a company based in Columbus, Governor DeWine was able to, was aware of it and was able to push back. And we know as a political matter, the fact that Governor DeWine, as a governor, going to the White House, making this a public issue, led to the White House going to the FDA and say, do you really believe it's better for doctors and nurses and EMTs to have no masks than to have masks that there is a tiny chance might have been improperly cleaned? And the FDA reevaluated the data and approved the cleaning technology. And that was certainly a good thing, but that would not have happened under a non-federal system because there would not have been someone with the power center with the profile on the podium that a governor had to be able to push back. And I think that's important. And in thinking about kind of the various points I made just on how to think about federalism generally in the context of a pandemic, I do think it's worth remembering that our goal here is not what's the perfect policy. We don't want to fall prey to the Nirvana fallacy. We don't want to make the perfect the enemy of the good. As I think everyone here today knows, public policy is rarely perfect. And what we are trying to do is have the best possible policy while avoiding really disastrous consequences, right? So we have to take the federal government that we have, not some imagined perfect federal government where everyone is wise and sage and brilliant and always making the right call, but rather a federal government that is imperfect information, that is subject to political pressures, and that is prone to make well-intentioned mistakes like any government. And in that world, it's a world where these benefits of federalism that I've been highlighting, I think, are particularly important and particularly valuable, because we're trying to always make sure we can get better policy. We are under no illusion that there is some magic elixir that can ensure we always adopt perfect policy from the outset. And I think when we look at the things the federal government has done and not done with regard to COVID, we can understand why this matters, because there are a bunch of areas where the federal government does have clear constitutional authority, does have a comparative advantage, where the federal government did not devote sufficient attention and did not devote its resources. The most obvious example probably relates to testing. The federal government did very little to encourage either approval of tests or the production of rapid at-home tests. We're only now really beginning to see the distribution and spread of at-home testing. The Biden administration is finally investing some resources and political capital into that. But that's something that should have been done much, much earlier. The pandemic would have been much different if we had had access to rapid at-home testing a year ago. So that even before there were vaccines, we could identify where spread is occurring, who has COVID, and people could self-isolate. And that failure was a result of the FDA adopting irrational and overly restrictive approval standards, combined with the federal government not using its power of the purse, its spending authority, to incentivize and reward the production and distribution of those tests. And I would argue that the more the federal government devotes its time and energy to things it's not good at and doesn't have the authority to do, the less likely it is to do the things that it has the authority to do and can do in an effective and an appropriate way. So now let's talk about some of the things the federal government has been doing or tried to do instead of the things it should be doing. And I'm going to focus on two, although we can talk about others if folks want to in the Q&A. I want to say a little bit about the eviction moratorium. And then as promised, I want to say a little bit about the OSHA emergency temporary standard, which was issued this morning. I'd like to claim credit for that if I could, but no one in the White House asked me about the timing, but certainly convenient that it was this morning. So let's talk first about the eviction moratorium, because I think the eviction moratorium, without question, it raises a lot of red flags if we're thinking about our federalist structure, if we're thinking about what does the federal government have the authority to do as opposed to what do state and local governments have the authority to do. Historically, questions of land use, definition of property, the protection of property, the relationship between landlords and tenants, all those questions are questions of state law. I sometimes teach property and I have to remind my students, you know, we teach these general principles, teach some Ohio law, but they have to be aware that these principles may be slightly different from state to state, that some states have slightly different rules on the margins related to some of these questions. And certainly landlord-tenant law is something where you can have a fair amount of state and local variation. On top of that, as we have already talked about, federal government has authority to deal with disease spread across borders, across state lines, across international borders, much less authority, much less regulatory authority in particular, to deal with disease spread within a state. So what the CDC tried to do, and this it initially did this under the Trump administration and then continued it into the Biden administration, was to adopt a moratorium on evicting individuals. Ostensibly, this was for the purpose of controlling interstate spread of COVID, but I don't think one has to be particularly cynical to look at the eviction moratorium, to look at who was calling for it, to look at the rationales that were given, to understand that this wasn't about interstate spread. This was about providing relief to members of vulnerable populations, people who maybe economically or otherwise are already living on the margins from being unduly or disproportionately impacted by the pandemic on top of their already dire or trying economic situation. So we may think that as a matter of justice or concern for our fellow citizens, that something of this nature is worthwhile. And many state and local governments adopted eviction-related policies to address these sorts of concerns, either eviction moratoria or special procedures to deal with eviction in the context of COVID. But various jurisdictions adopted measures to try and address these concerns. For our purposes today, the question is not, you know, should we do things to help people in these situations in the context of a pandemic, but whether or not this is the sort of thing that the federal government has the authority to do. And even if we think the federal government could do it, is this the sort of authority that Congress had given the Centers for Disease Control to exercise? Now, Section 361A gives the CDC broad authority to adopt disease control measures. But if you go and look at that language, you see that it's focused on vectors of transmission, things like diseased animals, diseased individuals. Neither the statute nor the implementing regulations that CDC adopted under it suggest that anything like the ability to control landlord-tenant relationships or otherwise interfere with or alter the enforcement of contracts with regard to land property, or for that matter, anything else. The CDC historically had always understood this authority to be about controlling the movement of things that could spread disease. Again, whether people, animals, and so on, and always involved those sorts of measures. There's a long, arduous procedural history related to the eviction moratorium was adopted and expired, then Congress endorsed it, then Congress's endorsement expired, CDC readopted. Went up to the Supreme Court initially when it was about to expire again in the Biden administration, and the Supreme Court said, we know that four justices were ready to invalidate it. Four justices seemed to think it was okay. Justice Kavanaugh wrote separately to say that while he thought it unlikely that the CDC had the authority because it was about to expire, it did not justify the Supreme Court intervening and offering extraordinary relief in that interim. One would have thought this gave a clear message to the Biden administration that if it wanted an eviction moratorium, it needed to go back to Congress. The Biden administration apparently went to Congress. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's response to the White House was, get better lawyers. So the Biden administration reissued the CDC eviction moratorium with only some slight limitations. Basically, it only applied in certain parts of the country based on the rate of COVID spread, but defined in such a way as to apply almost everywhere that the original moratorium did. It also provided that all a tenant needed to do was claim hardship and they automatically could not be evicted. And there's certainly some anecdotal evidence that many people who did not need this sort of relief took advantage of the moratorium to get away without, at least temporarily, without paying rent and not have to worry about being evicted. Of potential importance, just for those that are interested in the takings implications, the eviction moratorium by its terms did not extinguish the obligation to pay rent. It merely barred the relief of eviction. And you know, if one were to think about this from a taking standpoint, that would at least be potentially relevant because it would affect whether or not we think there is compensation, adequate compensation being provided. This new eviction moratorium was quickly challenged. It went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, we look at this language, we see traditional public health statutory language focused on the sorts of things that federal authorities would normally be concerned with, diseased animals crossing state lines, that sort of thing. We do not see anything suggesting the authority to offer an eviction moratorium. And further, even if we did read the language somewhat differently or thought it was ambiguous, we are not going to read ambiguous language to authorize something that so disrupts and distorts the traditional balance between the federal government and state governments as allowing the federal government to impose an eviction moratorium would. Invoking something that we often refer to as the major questions doctrine, the court basically said, this is the sort of thing that if Congress wants to do, we expect and demand Congress do explicitly and openly. We're not going to find an elephant in a mouse hole. We are not going to just presume that broad language about public health necessarily allows the federal government to insert itself into landlord-tenant relationships. That's an area of traditional state control. It's an area that implicates the constitutional protection of property rights. We are not going to assume that Congress gave the CDC the authority to pick that fight unless Congress was clear. And so the court enjoined the mandate or the eviction moratorium and struck it down. And at least to my knowledge, the Biden administration has not yet gone back to Congress to ask for a renewal of that. But some states have adopted measures, whether they are moratoria or something short of that, adopted measures to try and deal with those vulnerable populations for whom relief might be justified or worthwhile. And that is within the traditional police power of the states, provided they don't take actions that constitute an uncompensated taking of property. So eviction moratorium, an example of the federal government not heeding the traditional constraints on federal power and overreaching and losing as a result. Now, see where we are on time. I'm gonna briefly say a little bit about the emergency temporary standard that OSHA issued this morning. The entire rule, including the preamble, which will be published in the Federal Register tomorrow, is like 490 pages. I will confess I have not read every word of it. I have, as someone that does a lot of administrative law, I believe I've reviewed the parts that are of most salience and most importance, but it's long and there is something that I might have missed in terms of OSHA's defense of and justification of its rule. So OSHA is the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It has the authority to regulate occupational health and safety in workplaces. That's traditionally, or at least for the last 80 years or so, been understood as a permissible exercise of the federal government's power to regulate commerce among the states. Under existing doctrine, the idea that production is different from commerce has been abandoned. And so we generally, the courts generally allow the federal government to regulate economic activity generally. And so regulating workplaces is something that the federal government has the authority to do under current doctrine. What OSHA has the authority to do under its statute, under the Occupational Safety and Health Act, is to adopt standards that control risks in the workplace. Now, a couple of things just to clarify some common confusions about this. The risks do not have to be unique to the workplace, but OSHA's authority is limited to controlling those risks at the workplace. So for example, for many years, OSHA has had regulations governing bloodborne pathogens, risks of things like hepatitis from blood in various workplaces, and whether you're talking about dental offices or dry cleaners, there are lots of occupational settings in which we can anticipate workers might be exposed to bloodborne pathogens. Now, the risk of hepatitis is a risk that someone could be exposed to outside of work. That doesn't affect OSHA's authority. The fact that it's we're talking about a health risk, we're talking about an infectious agent as opposed to, say, a chemical, that doesn't matter either. Some have suggested that. That's not the way the act has ever been understood. But OSHA's authority is limited to the exposure that may occur at the workplace, not exposures that occur elsewhere. And certainly there is suspicion that the Biden White House is trying to use this, use OSHA as a way of encouraging measures that would reduce the spread of COVID more broadly. But we evaluate what OSHA is doing based on what it's doing at the workplace. That is built in to the statute. The normal standard the normal rule for an OSHA regulation governing a workplace risk is that the risk must be significant, and it has to be a significant risk in the workplace, and the measure has to be necessary or appropriate. And The Supreme Court, in some cases you may be familiar with, most notably the benzene case from 1980, has read this language in a way to kind of constrain or narrow OSHA's discretion for non-delegation reasons. What OSHA did here, though, is not a normal standard, because a normal standard requires going through the full notice and comment process. What OSHA did here was adopt what's called an emergency temporary standard. And for there to be, for an emergency temporary standard to be lawful, it's not enough that the risk be significant. It rather must be a, quote, grave danger. So the type of risk that that OSHA is trying to address has to be greater than the normal occupational risk that OSHA is focused on. And the measure has to be necessary to protect against that grave danger again in the workplace. The grave danger that OSHA is focused on here is the risk of COVID to unvaccinated workers. OSHA realizes that given the effectiveness of vaccines, claiming that COVID is a grave danger to those who are vaccinated would be a really heavy lift. That would be a hard argument to make. Now, what they are claiming is that COVID remains a very serious risk, a grave danger to those who are unvaccinated, and therefore OSHA has the authority to control exposures in the workplace that would present that grave danger. So what OSHA has done is they have said that all employers that have more than 100 employees firm-wide are subject to a requirement of either requiring all employees to be vaccinated or giving the employees a choice of vaccination or weekly testing combined with a requirement of masking in the workplace. So employers have one of those two choices. This has been portrayed and put forward as a vaccine mandate. There's a lot of reason to believe in practice that you will have a decent number of employers that are allowing their employees to test and mask instead. But the way the standard is written, employers are to have that choice. A couple other points about the standard that are worth, that OSHA issued today that are worth highlighting. One is that OSHA says that while this applies to all firms that have 100 or more employees, that the requirements do not need to be applied to employees who either do not work in a workplace, do not come to the workplace where they interact with other employees, work at home, or work full-time outside. So if you have, say, a company with a sales force and the salespeople are working from home or they're on the road and so on, they're not interacting with other employees at the workplace on a regular basis, they would not be subject to these requirements. And this is certainly something that was not previewed in the president's announcement of this, of OSHA adopting this standard 2 months ago. And I suspect it was added because I and others pointed out that having a flat 100 employee cap would be hard to justify given the language of the OSHA statute, because it's hard to argue that the number of employees employed by a single firm is a relevant proxy for the degree of risk or what sorts of measures might be necessary to reduce that risk, right? So an automobile plant where you have lots of people in confined space, okay, we can understand why the risk of spread there to those who are unvaccinated could well be quite significant, perhaps even rise to the grave danger level. But a workplace that is more distributed, where people have the option to work at home, where people do not have prolonged close contact in the workplace, that's harder for OSHA to reach. I still think that the way OSHA has written these exemptions may not be broad enough, because simple contact in the workplace is unlikely to be a grave danger. It's more likely to be prolonged interactions, non-socially distanced within confined area, and so on. And so I suspect that some of the challenges to this standard that will be filed will highlight that the rule that OSHA has adopted is not sufficiently tailored to meet the grave danger necessary to prevent a grave danger standard. There is a religious exemption. I'm not sure the religious exemption really matters, because of the test and mask option that the that the standard implies. And then, because we're talking about federalism, I should just note OSHA is claiming that the standard is preemptive of state law. I know this is relevant in Tennessee. The way OSHA is phrasing it is that this standard bars states from prohibiting vaccination or prohibiting vaccine requirements or prohibiting mask mandates and the like. OSHA claims that unless a state is operating under an OSHA-approved state plan, that any limitation of that sort, any limitation on what employers can do would be preempted by the standard. I'm not entirely sure if that will hold up since OSHA has adopted this standard where you either require everyone to be vaccinated or you allow people to opt out with testing and masking for the unvaccinated as an alternative, combined with exempting people that aren't coming into the workplace. Traditional conflict preemption principles would say that if a state or if a state law merely narrows the compliance options, but still allows you to comply with federal law, then the state law is not preempted. That is to say, we often read, we look at preemption in terms of the federal government establishing a floor with states able to go beyond that. The language in the preamble, I think, is not not convincing, at least to me, that default approach would not apply here. And I would not be at all surprised to hear some state attorneys general filing suit on that basis very soon. The one suit that I'm aware of that has already been filed, the Daily Wire. Yes, that Daily Wire apparently has filed suit today in the Sixth Circuit, challenging the OSHA emergency temporary standard. I don't know if they're going to raise the preemption issues, but I would expect the state attorney general will. I'm at, I think, about 45 minutes. So I'm gonna pause there. If folks have questions, I can look at the Q&A box. I don't know if there are folks that want to, Greg wants to call on folks. Greg, would you like me to just use the Q&A box or do it differently?
Well, why don't you, yeah, Professor Adler, why don't you, since you have access to it, there are two questions, and sure. I may have one too. So why don't you take those on, if you wouldn't mind, and just address those.
Okay, so the first question is on federal employees. So when President Biden announced his new COVID strategy back in September, he had announced multiple measures. The OSHA standard was one of them. There was one with applying to federal employees, one with regard to medical facilities that receive Medicare and Medicaid reimbursement, which I can say a little bit about if people want. And then one related to schools, which actually doesn't seem to be very significant in the sense that they're not really being aggressive there at all. There is a question about federal employees. My understanding is that the federal government has the authority to impose conditions on employment, and just as many employers impose a wide range of vaccination requirements on employees, the federal government may do so. We certainly most often see those sorts of requirements in educational or health-related settings, but legally there's not a reason why they necessarily need to be constrained to that. My own view on how the federal government as employer should approach this is that if the federal government is acting as an employer, I want the federal government to focus on what its needs are or what its responsibilities are as employer. I don't particularly like the idea of leveraging federal employment as a way of trying to achieve some other goal, such as increasing vaccination rates. And I say that as someone that's very pro-vaccination. I have my booster. If you guys aren't vaccinated, go get vaccinated. Vaccines work. They're a miracle of modern medicine. Thank goodness we have the number of vaccines that we have for the range of diseases that we have. And thank goodness that scientists are now capable of sequencing a virus like the coronavirus as quickly as they are so that we can have safe and effective vaccines. So I'm very, very pro-vaccine. My employer has a vaccine mandate. But my employer has a vaccine mandate because it wants to make sure that the educational environment it is providing for students is one that can operate regularly and vaccination as a way of preventing an outbreak here on campus, that would then disrupt our ability to hold classes, interact with students, and fulfill our educational mission. That strikes me as appropriate. If my university was saying, well, we're doing this so it will just increase vaccination generally in the community, I'd be a little less comfortable with that. It doesn't seem to me as an appropriate use of that authority. And I have a similar view towards the federal government, although I think so long as things like religious exemptions are provided, that religious and medical exemptions are provided, I think the federal government has the authority to impose vaccination requirements on federal employees, can do so in the military as it is done for other things as well. Anyway, if people have additional questions, put them in the Q&A box. There is another question on natural immunity. I don't see anything in the mandate that addresses a natural immunity. An individual that does not want to be vaccinated would have to be tested weekly and masked if they're coming into the workplace. Those are the options that employers with more than 100 employees may give. And legally, it's not clear to me that OSHA is required to make a carve out for natural immunity, although one might be able to make an argument that those that have had COVID but are unvaccinated are not in grave danger the way someone that has neither had COVID nor a vaccine might be. And that argument certainly might be made in one of the lawsuits challenging this. I am somewhat skeptical of it, but it is possible. The latest research we have shows that actually the combination of having had COVID and getting the vaccine is better than a vaccine and a booster. So if I had COVID, I would still get vaccinated. My daughter working in the emergency room ended up getting COVID. She still got vaccinated and got her booster. But the rule as written does not specifically identify that as a basis for an exemption. Although again, the way it is structured, employers are allowed to offer this weekly test and wear a mask alternative to mandatory vaccination. And so someone that has had COVID, is concerned about an adverse reaction to a vaccine as a consequence of having had COVID already, could avail themselves of that. And then again, as I noted, OSHA says that employers do not have to impose these restrictions on employees that either do not come into the workplace where they interact with other employees, work at home, or work full-time outside. So for those who have the option of telecommuting and the like, that would be another way for those with natural immunity to not have to get vaccinated. Would also do a lot for people that have religious objections, although the standard also notes that religious objections would have to be accommodated on a case-by-case basis as well.
Professor Adler, let me ask you this question. This is a little bit off the vaccine thing, which we've all been looking at, but I know you teach environmental law. From the standpoint of, you know, these federal initiatives, these environmental initiatives to, you know, try to phase out fossil fuels and, you know, to battle climate change and whatnot, what is the, maybe this is too difficult or too long of a question to answer in such a short time, but what is the relationship between the, for example, EPA issuing edicts and states being able to do it in terms of, formulating their own response to it or pushing back on it? What's the dynamic there between?
And there's some good parallels here. So that are worth about how it works in the environmental context versus how it's working in the pandemic context. So most of the major federal environmental laws operate under what we refer to as a cooperative federalism structure. So the federal government has adopted a set of standards that are the default standards and essentially default floor for all states. The federal government then invites states to assume the authority for implementing and enforcing federal law. And then states are allowed to adopt more stringent rules if they like. And the exemptions to this are generally involve things like regulation of vehicles or things that are that cross state lines and the like. So for example, there is a different approach for regulating automobile emissions than there is, say, regulating stationary sources, regulating factories, power plants, and the like. The Occupational Safety and Health Act does allow a cooperative federalism mechanism. There is a mechanism for states to adopt plans where they are effectively enforcing the Occupational Safety and Health Act, but it is not as widespread or pervasive as it is in the environmental context. The other thing that we see in the environmental context, which we see in the administration is doing with regard to reimbursements for Medicare and Medicaid providers, is using federal spending as an inducement for state cooperation. So under the Clean Air Act, for example, the federal government both offers states funds for if they adopt compliant programs, and then also threatens to withhold highway funds if states do not adopt compliant programs. I've argued that conditioning highway funds on compliance with the Clean Air Act is unconstitutional, but that sort of question has not reached the Supreme Court yet. But that's a very common feature. That's something the administration hasn't said that it's going to do with regard to Medicaid and Medicare providers, those providers that receive reimbursement for Medicaid and Medicare services. And so some background on that is that the federal government has a wide range of requirements for hospitals, dialysis centers, nursing homes, rehabilitation centers. If they're receiving Medicaid or Medicare reimbursement, there's a whole bunch of rules they have to satisfy, requirements they have to satisfy. And basically the idea is the federal government wants to make sure that the facility that is receiving federal reimbursement is in fact providing effective, safe care. And the federal government has argued that they are going to require vaccination in these facilities, of employees in these facilities, as a condition for reimbursement. The argument is essentially, well, if we're under Medicare, we are paying for this individual to receive dialysis treatment. We don't want a consequence of their federally funded or federally subsidized dialysis treatment to be contracting COVID. So we want to be sure that when they go to a dialysis center, the risk of COVID there has been reduced. Or when they go to a hospital and the federal government's going to be paying the bill, we want that risk to be reduced. And the argument the federal government's going to make is that this is kind of like saying, when we give you federal highway funds, you've got to build a safe highway. And so there are rules about guardrails and signage and how lines are marked and lighting and all sorts of things. Speed limits historically were part of the receiving the highway funds. The speed limit one was relaxed. Drinking age has not been. States that do not have an 18 drink or a 21 drinking age and that instead wanted an 18 drinking age could lose some of their highway funds. And the rationale was this leads to riskier highways. And that's what the federal government is funding. Because the Supreme Court upheld that last example that I gave, it said, yes, you can condition a portion of highway funds on the drinking age because it affects the safety of the highways that you are funding. I would think that the imposing requirements on those facilities and providers that receive Medicaid or Medicare reimbursement would likely be upheld, certainly by lower courts. My one hesitation there is that in the case of highway funding, states only risk losing a small portion of their overall highway funding if they didn't comply on the drinking age. Whereas here, it looks like CMS is going to say you could lose the ability to get any reimbursement. And so maybe courts would conclude that's sufficiently more coercive. And certainly since state-owned or operated hospitals could be affected by this, you might see some states challenge on that basis. But that's a common lever, using money. We see that in environmental law. We see that being used here as a way of advancing the federal. Yeah.
Professor Adler, just a little follow-up on that. Could you explain differences, if any, between putting conditions for a reimbursed facility versus a reimbursed healthcare provider? Are there any differences there?
I haven't seen the final rule, so I don't know if there are any distinctions there that are being made. The federal government is going to argue that essentially we are paying for a service and we can impose limitations or rules that ensure that that service is provided in the way that we want it provided. It's provided in a safe way, safe here being defined as sufficiently COVID-free or sufficiently reduced risk of COVID. And the line that has traditionally been drawn in a lot of cases is a line between how money is being used or things that relate to where the money is being used, as opposed to simply using money as a pressure point. And we all remember NFIB versus Sebelius, where the court concluded it was more being used as a pressure point, as a means of coercion. Here, the argument will be that it's simply saying, if you get Medicare or Medicaid money, we're writing you the check to pay for services you provided to a beneficiary, you have to meet a whole bunch of standards, and one of them is that your employees have been vaccinated.
Well, all right. Well, listen, Professor Adler, thanks so much for joining us today. We've had a wonderful presentation. We've all learned a lot. So thanks. And once again, we'll have you down here when hopefully things improve a little bit on the health side. But anyway, and I appreciate everyone attending today. If you haven't submitted you want CLE credit and hadn't submitted your BPR number, please do that. And anyway, everybody have a great rest of the day and a great holidays coming up. And we hope to see everybody again soon. Thanks again, Professor Adler.
Thank you.